Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
So what do, I don't know, post-it notes, the sport of curling, and geckos have in common with one another? Maybe a lot of things for all I know, but what I'm thinking about right now is stickiness. Because actually, I mean, curling maybe doesn't sound like it fits there, but curling actually does, in fact, run off of stickiness in a way that we will explain to you, because you're dying to know more about curling, when we begin the show right after the news. But yeah, the whole show today is about stickiness. Why things are sticky, what stickiness even means, what is the quality of stickiness, and how can it be harnessed for the good of others. And towards the end, we'll also tell you about the great chewing gum turndown of the pandemic.
Guess I'm on my way.
Do you think he means S-O-U-L or S-O-L-E? Because really, in terms of the terrain we will be traversing on today's show, S-O-L-E, like having really sticky feet, is much more to the point. But we're going to talk about stickiness today. And for some reason or other, we've been talking... Well, you know, it all started because Teresa Kremer, one of our regular panelists, was explaining that she disliked small children because of what she referred to as their jam hands. And everybody knew right away what she meant. You know, the kid comes up to you, the sticky hands, it's not a good feeling. I mean, it might not be an entire reason to discard children, but so we're going to talk about stickiness today, which turns out to be this extraordinarily complex thing. It's probably not just one thing. And even to the extent that it's just one thing, it immediately becomes two things. Let me give you an example. Paint has to be sticky, right? You can't paint your room with orange juice, even if you like the color of orange juice, because it'll just dribble down the wall. But it can't be so sticky that it won't go off the paintbrush, right? That would be like a Charlie Chaplin movie, trying to paint with really sticky paint, you know? Just like this would stick to the brush the entire time. So in stickiness, I think we're looking for a sweet spot all along. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about geckos. It turns out that, yes, spiders and ants and sea urchins can, you know, walk up walls or whatever. But really, when it comes down to, like, sticky feet, there's kind of geckos, and then there's everybody else. At the end of the show, we're going to talk about chewing gum, probably in a way that isn't entirely consistent with everything else that we've talked about, but consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. So with no further ado, I'm excited to introduce our first guest. She'll be with us for two-thirds of the show. Lori Winkless is a science writer, physicist, and author of the new book, Sticky, The Secret Science of Stickiness. And she's joining us, I believe, from New Zealand. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is, Colin. Hi. It's morning time here, so good morning.
Right. Actually, you know, first of all, happy belated Waitangi Day. Congratulations on winning a gold medal in the Winter Games on Waitangi Day. That was a big deal. We actually covered that on our show. I've got kind of and I assume you went to New Zealand to study stickiness, because one of the big questions we have is, why don't you fall off the earth into space? You know, living down there, you must have either very sticky feet or the surface of New Zealand is very sticky.
But we'll... thankfully, the laws of gravity still exist down here, so that's what holds us onto the planet. No, as you can probably possibly tell from my accent, I'm not actually from New Zealand originally. I'm Irish and moved here in 2016, end of 2016.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I would have guessed that as well, being Irish-American myself. Okay, so... First of all, I think maybe the first thing to say here, reading your book, is it's clear that, as I just said 2 seconds ago, stickiness is not really one thing, right? It's a whole bunch of things that kind of come together to create certain conditions under certain circumstances.
Yeah, there's no real scientific definition for stickiness, right? You know, we've got scientific definitions for lots of other things, like, you know, we can measure things like density or mass, but there's no actual kind of number that we can apply to something to define how sticky it is. Like, there are some other terms that we can use and do use to, you know, hint at it. Viscosity is one of them, right? So every liquid has a viscosity, and that basically means how gloopy it is. You might have something like water that might be fairly low down the scale, but then at the other end of the scale, you might have something like ketchup or honey. It has a much more gloopy substance. And that's because of these forces that are acting, this frictional force that acts between the molecules inside that liquid. And that's often those liquids are often considered to be kind of sticky liquids. Then you've also got things like adhesives, right? You've got things like super glue that can stick lots of different objects together. And in fact, you've got hundreds and thousands of different adhesives that you can use to stick different materials together. And one of the weird things about stickiness is that adhesives, they can't do everything. You always have to know what surfaces you're putting your glue onto in order to find the right one to do the right job. And you mentioned paint as well. It's the same thing. You're going to get the right paint for the right job so that it will stay on the surface for as long as possible. You could even argue, and I certainly argue, that between two solid objects, you have a type of stickiness, which is really just friction, dry friction. And that's something I explore a lot in the book. So really, you know, I wrote a whole book about it because it really is hard to define in just a couple of sentences.
Right. One of the things that became clear to me quickly into the book is that, well, I'll give you an example. So I bought these winter boots that I use for hiking, and for whatever reason, part of the rubber bottom of them kind of came loose. And so I went and got some, I think, Gorilla Glue, which is a product here in the U.S. that's, you know, in that kind of super glue category. But and I kind of squirted it into the cracks of the boots and then squished it all together and kind of stepped back and thought, well, maybe it's fixed now. Well, it wasn't. And I'm sensing one of the many mistakes that I probably made was, you know, if there's any other stuff, if there's a little bit of water in there, if there are a little bit of, you know, sand particles in there, you're already talking about a pretty complex and nuanced set of chemical and physical interactions. Introducing any variables probably also hurts the ability of the thing to work.
Yeah, precisely that. Like, whatever is happening on the surface has a huge role to play. So, you know, sometimes if we are painting a surface, we'll be told to sand it. You know, you want to sand it beforehand to get the paint to stick. And actually, it seems like doing that really is just about cleaning the surface. It's about removing those contaminants in the way. So if your hiking boots, like you said, had some dust or dirt in there in that gap, it just makes it hard for the glue to actually work its way into the rough patches and to bind those things together. Because most of these glues, and even things like sticky tape, they don't actually make any sort of chemical bond between substrates. They just are very stretchy and they can flow and they can fill in the gaps. So when you then try to pull them apart, you're kind of having to stretch a very, very flexible, very well spread out liquid. So it's not actually a chemical bond. It's just a mechanical bond. It's just pressure, effectively. So yeah, looking at making sure your surface is as clean as possible will give the glue an opportunity to flow and stay in the right place. Temperature makes a difference too. So some glues are particularly good at low temperatures. So maybe your hiking boots would need something that's better for, you know, 0°C or closer to that. So there is an awful lot to consider. It's never just as simple as we think.
Right. And so I think also if we were Greek philosophers walking through the Lyceum, we probably would divide stickiness into two categories, things that are intentionally sticky, things that we want to be sticky, and then things that are unintentionally sticky. That would include children's hands, the floors of movie theaters. Certain things get sticky in a way that we don't want them to be. But let's look at that first category first. It seems to me that and I my dating will be imprecise, but in the 70s or 80s, one started to see commercials for things for, you know, just easily retail available products called super glue and various versions of that name. And the commercials always showed, I don't know, like an elephant being, you know, held up by a steam iron or something, you know, just stuck to it, and it could, the super glue could do anything. I sense reading your book that that may be a somewhat exaggerated claim, that it's impossible to make a glue that won't fail under any circumstances.
Yeah, it really is. And when I spoke to people who are kind of working in this, who are developing adhesives, that was their main point. It's like, don't expect any single glue to do everything for you. Because they talk about this thing, they say adhesion is a property of the system. So it means that everything has to work together in order to stay stuck. So that will include things like, what forces will this stuck object have to withstand? Right, once it's in use. So say I manage to stick my sole of my boot back onto my boot. The forces that's going to have to withstand are a tension force, a pulling force. So you'll design a glue that makes it hard to kind of be pulled apart. Whereas in other certain situations, you might want to have a glue that can withstand being squished together. It might be under compression. So you can design and choose different molecules that will behave well in those conditions. So it really is. Super glue is pretty great. It does stick to a lot of things, but it doesn't always do so in a particularly controlled manner. As you know, if you get it stuck on your fingers and it hardens like instantly. So it can make a pretty good bond with most substrates, but usually there is an ideal glue for whatever your need is.
Yes, I mean, super glue also rather comically can get your finger stuck to the thing that you were working on in the first place.
Yes.
and hilarious complications ensue. So there's a whole other category of stuff, maybe even between those two things that the Greek philosophers would be talking about. And that would be things that stick just enough. And sometimes, and so the best example, and the story has been told many times, I think people sitting around campfires say it now, how the post-it note, the sticky note was invented at 3M. But for those who have never heard it, give them that story.
Yes, this is one of my favorites. It seems kind of iconic to me. And of course, I had to write about it, right? Yeah. So there are two different chemists who are attributed with the invention of post-it notes. And they were both at what is now 3M. And the two guys are Spencer Silver and Arthur Fry. Now, Silver had been working on really, really strong adhesives for use, I think, by the military or the aerospace industry, and had, you know, been trying lots of different polymer compounds, lots of different mixtures, and found this very slightly sticky adhesive that could be sprayed. So it wasn't at all what they needed. They wanted like an ultra strong adhesive, but instead they had this very mildly sticky adhesive. So he kind of set it aside from that project, but kept it in his pocket and eventually went on to patent the actual adhesive. Now, his colleague Art Fry was a very famous, like very fond of his choir. He loved singing and would use bookmarks to mark his positions in any song. But of course, the bookmarks would move. And you know, this feels like such a bizarre thing because post-it notes are so ubiquitous now, but he didn't have a way to hold his bookmarks in place. And he thought, if I could find a semi-sticky liquid that I could temporarily, you know, could just hold the bookmarks in place without damaging the paper, we'd have it. And he remembered a presentation that Silver had given at the company about this thing that they had patented. So the two kind of knocked their heads together and decided maybe we could design this kind of removable post-it, this removable note. Now, from there to getting to post-it notes, there were so many engineering solutions that they had to come up with. The first thing is they needed to make a glue for this glue. They needed this mildly sticky adhesive to actually stay on the paper. Otherwise, each time you lifted a note off, it would leave some of the glue, some of the residue behind, which you don't want. So they had to invent a whole new glue to hold these tiny little particles of adhesive onto the paper. Then they had to find a way to print that onto the paper in mass quantities so that they could roll the glue onto these little strips that we now think of as the top of those post-it notes. And apparently the first machine, the first kind of printer that they designed, they built in Art Fry's basement, and it gradually became so big that when they wanted to move it back into the factory, when they got kind of thumbs up from 3M management to scale it up, they had to knock out the wall. So it took a long time and lots of different engineering solutions to get to that point. And now, you know, it's been a massive success.
Yes, we should mention that Spencer Silver passed away last year at the age of 80.
Yes.
The New York Times obit was just fascinating. It's clear that he was kind of Jesus and Mr. Fry was the Apostle Paul, the one who kind of got the word out. It's a terrific story. Now, we're going to go from there to... And Lori, I just want to say, as excited as we all got over Zoe Sadowski Sinnott's gold medal in slopestyle or whatever it was, you know, the world's attention has turned to this other spine-tingling Olympic sport. Let's hear a little bit of it.
Go ahead, Maddie.
Go, Maddie.
Heavy.
Really gotta go.
Needs to get this close to the nose.
Oh, boy.
Well, yeah.
That's what we're all day.
Okay. And that will be four. A massive mistake for Team USA in this end, and Canada rockets in front by five. Off the charts difficult. Can Schuster pull it off?
You made it for one.
Did I?
Well,
that's pretty exciting.
They do scramble and at least get a point out of it. It is one red.
All right. I don't know about anybody else. I'm hyperventilating a little bit here. Everybody just take a moment to calm down. That, of course, is a clip from the sport of curling. Now, curling kind of involves, and one thing that your book makes clear immediately, is that there's stickiness on one end of the continuum and there's sort of slipperiness on the other end. And neither one of these things is easily defined or maybe one unified concept. But there's a way in which stickiness and slipperiness kind of almost need each other. And I think with curling, you would think only about the slipperiness, but you make a very compelling case in the book that the stickiness is part of the whole story too. Is there a way you can kind of sketch that out for us laypersons?
Yeah, for sure. I too am obsessed with curling. So one thing to say is that you'll notice that the players will have one slippery shoe and one grippy shoe. So that's one thing. They use one rubber sole, which can hold on to the ice, and one Teflon usually sole that allows them to slide along the ice. But curling is really unusual compared to other winter sports, because if you look at a curling ice sheet compared to, say, a speed skating oval. Speed skating oval tends to be very, very reflective, very hard, very smooth ice. A curling ice sheet tends to look matte, and that's because it's actually covered in what we call pebbles. These are just bumps of, they basically spray it with water, and as the water hits the ice, it forms onto these little bumps. And the curling stone itself, if you look at the base of a curling stone, it's concave, so it's not flat. Only a small ring of the curling stone actually touches the ice, and that ring is quite rough. It's a granite stone, and it's actually roughened. So you've got this rough stone, and then you've got this weird kind of textured ice. And as a player releases the stone, you will see that they rotate it slightly as they release it. If you throw a curling stone straight, it will mostly go straight. But if you rotate it as it goes, it curls. It does what the name suggests. The weird thing is that the way that a curling stone moves on pebbled ice is very different from, say, a bottle sliding on a surface. And we still don't quite fully have the physical explanation for what is going on. The leading idea is that as the stone slides along the ice, each time the rough edge of the stone hits this textured pebbles, it causes the stone to rotate ever so slightly. You know, it rotates in about, I think it's 40 nanoseconds, right? It's millions of times quicker than you can blink. But it does that many thousands of times as the stone slides along the ice sheet, and that will cause it to kind of pivot around and rotate, and it forms this curling path. There is another theory that maybe the stone is actually scratching the ice as it moves along. But to be honest, that theory is a bit less well developed at the moment. So probably the leading theory is what they call the pivot slide theory. And when you see a player sweep the ice, what they're actually doing is they're trying to straighten out the stone's curl. So they're trying to kind of fight against the natural curl. And usually by sweeping, you melt the ice a tiny bit in front of the stone, and it helps the stone to travel further in a straighter path. So there's a real mixture, like friction, a slipperiness, play a huge role in curling. And I think it's why it's my favorite winter sport.
Yeah. And there's no way to talk about stickiness without talking about friction, it seems. And so what you're really talking about is either increasing or reducing friction in order to affect the trajectory or path or speed of the stone. All right. Well, you're probably a little bit overexcited now after we've been talking about curling. So we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back. And it's going to get more exciting because we're going to talk about geckos. So get ready.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Don't attract much attention. But speculation as to how they stick has mostly come from watching geckos taking walls in their stride. But the smoothest plaster is not really smooth when viewed close up under an electron microscope. Could these tiny bumps rub against the gecko's textured soles to make a friction hold? This, after all, is what stops trainers from slipping at the gym. But no one can make trainers grip upside down.
That, of course, is David Attenborough. I shouldn't need to tell you that. And joining us now, well, we have Laurie Winkless, of course, science writer, physicist, and author of the new book, Sticky, The Secret Science of Stickiness. But also we have with us Dr. Alyssa Stark, a professor at Villanova University. She runs a lab that studies biological adhesion. Welcome to our conversation.
Hi, good to have you, meet you here.
And so my sense in reading Lori's book and reading about you is that, yes, there's lots of animals. Spiders can climb up walls and hang from the ceiling, and so can ants. And but there's sort of, in some way, there's geckos and then there's everybody else. So, Alyssa, what's so special about geckos?
Yeah, well, they're quite charismatic, right? They're a larger organism, so they attract a lot of attention. But their adhesion is actually quite different than a lot of other biological adhesive systems. A lot of biological adhesive systems use a glue, so they actually produce a secretion. And we were just talking about earlier on the show things like super glue and you know, children's glue that we use in our everyday life. Geckos actually don't have that. So that's kind of what sets them apart. As you heard in that little clip, they have very hairy toes instead. So those hairs actually allow geckos to maximize surface area. So those tiny, tiny little hairs are actually contacting quite a bit of the surface. And by that multiple, all those multiple contacts in the surface or on the surface, it allows geckos to generate very high adhesion forces through very simple kind of forces that are around us all over, which are van der Waals forces.
Right. So, Lori, interestingly enough, there are two contexts in your book in which the term curling comes up. We just covered one of them, the sport of curling. But it's also, there's sort of a curling, uncurling action of the gecko's feet, Lori, that allows it to maximize what Alyssa has just described.
Yes, because like Alyssa says, you know, the geckos are amazing because they can kind of turn on and off their stickiness, right? That's what allows them to move so quickly. And the way that they do it is they want to change the angle of those hairs on their hairy toes. And by curling their toes back from a surface, they can detach those hairs, changing the angle that they make with the wall, which kind of turns down or turns off really the van der Waals forces. It separates it from the wall enough to get rid of van der Waals forces. And when they want to stick, they place their feet against whatever the surface is and they tug it down ever so slightly, which causes those hairs to splay out and it turns on those van der Waals forces again. So they can turn their stickiness on and off, which is one of the reasons that so many people are fascinated by them.
You know, Alyssa Stark, as we were having a staff meeting about this this particular episode, and I'm not going to name any names, but it turned out that one of our producers has owned geckos in the past, and she was under the impression that they had little tiny suction cups. Apparently even people who own geckos do not know their fantastic secret.
Yes, definitely. I've heard that, and I've also heard kind of Velcro. So if you look at the bottom of their feet, and not all geckos are sticky, by the way, so you have to have the right gecko. But if you look at the bottom of the feet of a sticky gecko, especially if they're attached to maybe the side of their tank, if you have a pet gecko, you'll see lines on their toes. And those lines are actually full of those very, very microscopic hairs that you can't see by eye. There's no suction happening there. It's just the hair contact.
Now, recently, a controversy exploded. It has nothing to do with insurance commercials, but it does have to do with sticking to walls. Kat, this is going to be A2. You will recognize the voice immediately.
Because a new study from Cambridge University, yeah, the smart one, says that according to their calculations, Spider-Man should not be able to climb walls. Boo! Boo! I'm not questioning these scientists' credentials. I think they're the ones who tried to warn us that Spider-Man could not be a Broadway show. But we didn't listen. We didn't listen! But no wall climbing? I mean, that's one of the main things that Spider-Man does. Without that, he just shoots goo and is radioactively guilty about his uncle. But according to the study, the largest animal capable of wall climbing is the gecko. And I'm not sure if Kirsten Dunst wants to kiss one of those upside down.
So, Lori, what followed was a video which I watched today. We're not going to play it because it's kind of visually dependent, of a Stanford University scientist named Elliot Hawks rebuking Stephen Colbert and then demonstrating how he could, with something he was attaching to his hands and feet, climb up a wall. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I loved this, and Elliot is a really, really nice guy, and is always keen to talk about it too. He basically used, in Stanford for a long time now, they've been developing this kind of gecko-inspired adhesive tape. Now, it's nowhere near as complicated as the gecko's foot. It doesn't have, the features are much larger than the tiny, tiny hairs that, Alyssa's been talking about. But it had taken some inspiration in that it uses these kind of wedges, these silicone wedges that point in one direction, and that if you change the angle, you change the way it touches the wall, that splays out or shrinks back like the hair, and it taps into this van der Waals force. So Elliot used this gecko-inspired tape and basically built a climbing machine based on it. So the gecko tape was applied to these kind of flat in small segments, kind of postage stamp sized pieces of this tape. He put them onto these flat paddles. Each one of those little bits of tape was attached to effectively kind of like a wire that would help to curl and uncurl it. And then these two hands were connected by a long kind of pole to a foot support. So what it would mean is that he could lift his right hand up and his right foot would go with it, and then put the paddle in contact with the wall, tug it down, turn on the van der Waals forces, and then do the same with his left foot. And he managed to get up, I think it was about 4 meters up a glass wall on a building on Stanford campus. So yeah, he was really determined to show that it would be possible to do that.
Actually, Tom Cruise went way higher in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. But so, Alyssa, you're kind of on speed dial from a lot of companies who want to figure out something, right? That nature has these incredible, nuanced, mysterious at times capacities that people would like to tap into one way or another. So, what do they tend to be interested? Like, who tends to be interested in this?
Yeah, so it really can range quite a bit. It could be anything from medical devices is very popular, or any sort of medical healthcare needs. It can also be just practical uses. We need something that sticks underwater on a boat, for instance, or something that sticks on our body, like a bra, or other ways to attach, you know, equipment for, say, our pilots and things like that, people that are going to be maintaining location for long periods of time. So it really kind of has run the gauntlet. I've been quite surprised of the different requests and interests I've gotten, and many things I never would have thought of. You know, a temporary adhesive in the eye for 30 seconds. I would have never thought that was a need.
Right. You mentioned bras. We do know that you actually did get a call, right, from Victoria's Secret.
I
thought there was a whole other process for getting those products sticky. But you also mentioned boats and underwater. And in a way, geckos are so last year, right? Sea urchins are so 2022. Explain what they have to do with all this.
Yeah. So my lab works on several different sticky creatures. I really am interested actually in adhesives that have to stick and release. So like Lori said, geckos run really fast. Ants run really fast. Sea urchins do not run very fast, but they do actually still move. And people don't know that. Those are those little spiky balls that you see in tide pools if you go out looking at a low tide. And those organisms are actually herbivores. So they're moving around on those surfaces and needing to stay attached while they're being literally pummeled by waves and exposed to predators. And then they're doing it in water, which is another challenge we kind of mentioned earlier. Water often is one of the most difficult challenges for adhesives to get over, basically, to be able to adhere while in a wet or a humid environment. And sea urchins are doing that. So that's a new system in my lab that we're starting to work on more now, because it's not just a permanent glue in salt water. It's a glue that can be released and moved around.
Lori, we've only got about 90 seconds left in this segment, but one thing that somebody says in your book, and I'll missay it now, but in your gecko chapter is, there's a way in which nature really does inspire a certain kind of humility. I mean, we might want to try to reverse engineer some of these biological capacities, but it's not that easy, right? Nature just does stuff that we can't do.
Yeah, we are nowhere close to being able to reproduce the level of complexity that we see on a gecko's foot. I'm not sure that we would ever have invented it had we not seen it in nature, or, you know, even thought that it could possibly exist if we hadn't seen it in nature beforehand. But, you know, evolution's had a long time to fine tune its design, whereas really we have only been trying to engineer bio-inspired systems for, you know, just a few decades. So we need to cut ourselves some slack on that. Maybe we'll catch up.
All right. That is a philosophical point on which to end this segment. Thanks to Dr. Alyssa Stark, professor at Villanova University. She runs a lab that studies biological adhesion. Lori Winkless, science writer, physicist, and author of the new book, Sticky, The Secret Science of Stickiness. And we are going to take a break right now. We are going to ask you to stay for one final segment. We are going to say goodbye to these two wonderful guests and approach from a different angle something else that's very sticky. That sticky thing would be chewing gum.
I'm stuck on you, uh-oh, stuck like glue. You and me, baby, we're stuck like glue. Uh-oh, stuck like glue. You and me, baby, we're stuck like glue. Uh-oh, stuck like glue. You and me, baby, we're stuck like glue.
Chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 baby.
Time to say some thank yous. So thank you to our technical producer, Kat Pastor. Thanks to Julia Pistel, who produced this episode, and senior producer Lily Tyson, who has overseen everything as she always does. So our final segment is a little bit different from what has preceded it. We've been talking about stickiness. Now we're going to talk about something sticky, something that you may have found on the underside of your shoe. No, not that. Something a little less unpleasantly sticky than that. That would be chewing gum. Chewing gum is a pretty much ever-present part of American life, as we will discuss. It is interlaced with various kind of symbolic narratives about America. I'll tell you my favorite one. We're going to play this clip right now. Maybe I should set it up. This is from The Right Stuff. You're going to see Sam Shepard as Chuck Yeager approaching a mechanic, I guess is what he is, played by Levon Helm. And this is – so Chuck Yeager was the most famous test pilot in the world. And for a long time, he was kind of symbolic of a certain streak of Americanism. And so apparently he and this mechanic had a ritual, sort of a good luck ritual, every time Yeager showed up to go flying into the sky in one of these not entirely safe or very well proven machines – hence the term test pilot. So here's what they would say to one another.
Hey, Ridley.
Yeah.
You got any beamings?
I might have me a stick.
Well, loan me something, would you? I'll pay you back later.
Fair enough.
I think I see a plane over here with a name on it.
So here to tell us what's happening to chewing gum right now, which is maybe a different narrative, Will Caldwell, a freelance writer and regular contributor to The Guardian, Economist, and Financial Times. He is the writer of the Economist article, Bursting the Bubble, How Gum Lost Its Cool. So first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Hi there.
And let's begin with the headline itself. Something happened during the pandemic, something that was not good if you make your living making or selling chewing gum. Describe the phenomenon.
Yeah, well, during the pandemic, for a number of reasons, people just stopped chewing gum. I guess, you know, the obvious thing is that everyone had face masks over their mouths, but also people weren't going out, partying, going on dates, going on road trips and driving around and stopping by garages, all these places where people would traditionally grab some gum and have a chew. So, yeah, sales dropped by about 14% in 2020, which was, you know, pretty difficult for the gum industry.
Right. So we should talk a little bit more about what chewing gum is, because not so much what it is, the physics and chemistry of what it is, but what it is symbolically, because people chew it for all kinds of different reasons. But there's a sense that when you are chewing it, you're doing more than just masticating. And one of the things that you point out is you know, although and maybe in a way that ties into Chuck Yeager, too. Chuck Yeager, ultimately a rugged individual, a guy who rebelled, the guy who did his own thing. So maybe he needs some Beemans before he gets in that terrifying machine. But there's a way in which rebellion and gum have gone hand in hand. Say some more about that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with gum is that it's quite a, you know, nothing-y product. It's sort of what you make of it. And over the years, people have attached all kinds of ideas and identities to it. And during the Second World War, particularly, it became very patriotic. It was associated with the American GI. And then, you know, because Americans were perceived as, you know, the ultimate, the pinnacle of cool around the world, particularly in Britain at the time, young people started chewing gum to emulate these guys. Hollywood stars were chewing gum, which made it hit, you know, the world over. And then, you know, this spilled into pop culture. So gum generally kind of became associated with, you know, rock stars having a bit of attitude, you know, and this just continued throughout the second half of the 20th century. You know, I guess you could, one example of this kind of how desirable gum was in terms of pop culture, perhaps was when a piece of gum spat out by Britney Spears was sold on eBay for, you know, £10,000. But, you know, then things kind of took a bit of a turn for gum in after the millennium. It started to lose that cool. So the thing is even while the pandemic was very unfavorable for chewing, gum was already on the wane.
I just have flashed to another thing, and this may not resonate with you, but you may be the wrong age, but for a long time, forever, I think, when David Letterman was hosting a late night television show, if a guest arrived on stage chewing gum, which oddly enough was not that uncommon an experience, Letterman, in his best imitation of a high school vice principal, would hold out a sheet of paper. And the guest was expected to place the gum in the middle of the sheet of paper so that Letterman could crumple it up and throw it in the waste paper basket. Because there is that thing about the Breakfast Club, right? There's a way in which you're chewing gum. When you chew gum, you are sending a signal that you do not take this situation seriously enough to achieve a level of formality. Does that sound fair?
Oh, yeah, completely. It's you know, indifferent, you know, slightly angsty. It's, you know, it's I've got something better to do than give my complete attention to whatever's going on around me.
Right. I mean, you know, in solemn British coronations and other royal occasions, you're just not even going to see Princess Beatrice or somebody chewing gum. You can't be doing that. So now let's talk a little bit about the pandemic. You already laid out a lot of circumstances that changed. Some people would argue that gum also is kind of a last minute decision, that you don't necessarily go to the grocery store with chewing gum on your list of things to get. But as you approach the cash register, which is, of course, that's why they put it there, you see it, you think, oh, yes, that would be nice to have. But people were acquiring their groceries differently, right? They were ordering them. They were ordering them in a way that's maybe a little bit more hyper-conscious.
Yeah, completely. I mean, gum's kind of grab and go product. You'd buy it, you know, as you check out or on your way to a night out, or, you know, maybe just ask someone if they've got a spare piece of it. You are probably unlikely to put in an order of 100 pieces of Wrigley's on your online grocery delivery.
Well, yeah. And so now, not to get too deeply into the semiotics of gum, there's a way in which also gum is something that we chew to freshen our breath. It's one of the many reasons we do it. There's some indication. There's now been a lot of studies of chewing gum. Maybe it enhances concentration. Maybe it helps relaxation. But that idea of freshening one's breath is another reason why people aren't buying it. Although we have two different freelance producers, including the one who's producing this episode, who said that they craved gum because of their masks. It meant that they were more aware of the smell of their own breath since they were trapped there with it. The gum became more attractive. I suppose it sort of depends on what you're using the gum for, what you're more concerned about, how you feel about your own breath or how other people feel about it.
Yeah, completely. In honesty, like, lots of people do still really enjoy chewing gum, and it is an easy way to freshen your breath when you're out and about. I suppose lots of those circumstances when you may be more self-conscious of how your breath smells were eradicated by lockdown. You're just at home alone with your breath. But yeah, I mean, people have lots of reasons to chew gum. Apart from that, I suppose people do, you know, people do anecdotally find it helps them concentrate, or it can, you know, help them if they're feeling peckish, you know, just to stave off hunger. And these are all, you know, things that the gum industry have tried to research and develop products and sell products around, because, you know, they're always trying to come up with new reasons and arguments why, you know, we should be chewing gum.
I mean, as you point out, this isn't a fashion that necessarily descended upon us, you know, in the last 50 years or so. You point out that humans have been chewing various barks and resins for thousands of years, and that modern chewing gum dates from the 1860s. I guess there's a reason that chiclets are called chiclets, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, humans have always kind of had some kind of desire to chew. So there obviously is something innately satisfying about it. But yeah, you know, for centuries, Mayans and Aztecs chewed chicle, which was this resin that came from a tree in Mexico. And this is a, you know, core product of chiclets, I believe. And though in the 1950s or so, you know, gum manufacturers in America decided to start making synthetic gums out of rubber and plastic, which is the predominant gum we now chew today.
You know, there was sort of a period of time in America where, I don't know about England, but there was a period of time in America in the early part of the 20th century where everything was sold as a health product. I mean, Coca-Cola was introduced as a health product. You know, it was supposed to confer all kinds of health benefits. And I gather that's a little bit the case with gum, too. We have a baseball stadium here in America called Wrigley Field, named after the purveyor of Wrigley chewing gum. And apparently it was, first of all, I think, according to your reporting, first of all, included as a free thing with baking powder and soap that was being sold, became more popular. But it was sold with the promise of health benefits, right? Chewing gum would be good for you.
Yeah, it was almost like a form of kind of medication as opposed to, you know, a sweet or a candy. You know, Wrigley's came up with sort of arguments that, yeah, gum would solve whatever kind of petty ailment or anxiety you were dealing with. And, you know, I suppose like many habit forming products, they kind of do provide sort of, you know, gum does provide some sort of mild distraction or relief, I suppose.
Yeah, here in America, there was a soda called Moxie sold around the same time, more popular than Coke for a while. And among the so-called benefits of Moxie were the prevention of loss of manhood and softening of the brain. So I drank a lot of Moxie and it does not work. There's a commercial for a product called Extra Gum. It's become viral. I think there's 7 million views on the extended, you know, 2.5 minute version of this commercial. And what it shows is this kind of magical kind of liminal moment in which the pandemic ends. This is, by the way, not the way it's going to happen, but there's a day, there's a moment, there's an hour. Everybody says, oh, it's okay. And doors open and people with big long beards come walking out and people flood into the streets, into the public parks, which technically have never been really off limits during the pandemics. But and what they really want to do also, apparently, is begin making out with each other. And there's a way in which they – and then, of course, packs of extra gum are produced from pockets in order to facilitate the pleasure of making out with total strangers. And So the question is that going to happen? Is it happening yet? There's obviously something of a drop in the infection rate. Is that big hard hit that chewing gum took, is it coming to an end?
Well, I don't know if we're seeing scenes quite like that advert yet, though. I'm sure people would love that to happen. Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a bit of a bounce back to pre-pandemic levels, which makes sense. People are out and about again. I think one of the bosses at one of the big gum brands pointed to people being on the move again, on the road. And I think they're now trying to develop more kinds of, bumper boxes of gum that you can stick in your car and leave there. And so obviously the gum companies are kind of trying to hone in on this, people being on the move again. I guess the thing is I think this downturn is much bigger than just the pandemic. So if gum's having a bit of a recovery because of these extraordinary couple of years, I don't know if that's necessarily going to change the fact that for the last 10, 15 years, people have been kind of turning away from it more generally.
Right. I'm going to end with one very unscientific thought about this. I mean, it's an unscientifically proven thought. One thing that occurred to me reading your piece is that when you chew gum, for a lot of people, some people are able to rather demurely chew gum. But for most people, their mouths come open a bit as they're chewing. And particularly if you're a member of the Breakfast Club and you want to piss off the teacher who's running your detention hall, you definitely want to do that. You want to have almost a kind of a slackness in your mouth as you're chewing gum. I'm just sort of wondering if that maybe contributed to some of the paranoia. I mean, who wants to have their mouth open more in the middle of an airborne pandemic? So everybody can just file that away as a very unscientific observation. But it does sound as though there'll be a rebound, that gum in its sticky, bouncy way is going to bounce back, but maybe not all the way back. I guess that's what we're saying, Will.
Yeah, I do think so. Though, I mean, if the history of gum shows us anything, these brands have done very well at conjuring up new ways to sell, ultimately, a fairly pointless product that offers almost no nutritional value or benefit at all, other than, giving you something to do with your jaw. So I'm sure they'll figure something out.
Right. Either that or I'll be walking around a landscape littered with dead bodies saying, oh, it turns out the gum was really valuable. They shouldn't have stopped. All right. Well, thanks very much to you. Thanks to everybody who listened. Thanks to Julia Pestel and her fascination with stickiness. We will be back with more and more shows of this type.
We see just what we want to see all coming back to me. The flesh and the fantasies all coming back to me. I can barely recall, but it's so